Matthew 25, beginning in verse 14, there's a parable of Jesus we're going to look at today. We are in a series called Relearn, and basically it's been you getting to get in on conversations God's been having with me about my own personal thing, my own personal life. So when I preach on this subject of money today, I'm thankful that you stayed for the occasion, but you need to know that this is an intensely personal message for me personally, to remind me of things that I have learned in the past about the faithfulness of God. So we're gonna look at that today, and we're gonna be just checking our hearts about that this morning. Beginning in verse 14, the parable of the talents. Jesus speaking, he says, "For it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted to them his property. To one, he gave 5 talents, to another, 2, to another one, 1, to each according to his ability. Then he went away. He who had received the 5 talents went at once and traded with them, and he made 5 talents more. So also he who had 2 talents made 2 talents more. But he who had received the 1 talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. Now after a long time, the master of those servants came and settled accounts with them. And he who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing the 5 talents more, saying, 'Master, you've delivered to me 5 talents. Here I've made 5 talents more.' And his master said to him, 'Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master.' And he also had the two talents came forward, saying, 'Master, you delivered to me 2 talents. Here I've made 2 talents more.' And his master said to him, 'Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master.' He who also had received the 1 talent came forward, saying, 'Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here, you can have back what is yours.' But his master answered him, 'You wicked and slothful servant. You knew that I reaped where I had not sown or gathered where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I should have received interest, what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to them who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has will more be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness, in the place where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Well, God, may he bless the reading of his word. There are 3 words in our lifestyles together that are pretty powerful words: money, sex, and power. Money, sex, and power. And these are 3 very fascinating forces, and all of them are gifts of God. And all of them can do great good. But they also can derail our lives when we get messed up in dealing with them correctly. Now, I'm sure that no one in here struggles much with power. Because we don't live in a part of that world that attracts people to power issues, right? So we don't struggle with that. So that kind of leaves money and sex, right? So let's just take a little quick survey here. How many of you would say, "I have much bigger problems with sex than I have with money"? Raise your hand. Oh, thank you. So, what does that say? That only leaves money, right? So that's where we are today. If it leaves money, then let's focus on that for just a second. If you've got a pen, write this down. We're going to do a little true-false test. If you got a pen, you're going to write a T or an F after some questions I ask you. If you don't have a pen, just do it mentally, because it's not very much. It's just 5 little questions. But I want to ask you true or false in 5 specific questions, and let's take a little survey of where we are with this thing. True or false? Number 1, I have at least once spent money unwisely. True or false? Number two, true or false, I have at least once compared myself with someone else financially. I compared myself at least once with somebody else financially. Number three, true or false, I have written a check that was under-deposited. True or false? Number four, true or false, I have felt guilt over how much I have and the affluence of my lifestyle. True or false? And number five, true or false, I have wished that I were way more generous than I am. I am way more generous than I am. I have at least once spent money unwisely, compared myself with someone else financially, written a check that was under-deposited, felt guilt over the influence of my lifestyle, wish I were way more generous. True or false on those five questions? Now, I want to make the confession part of this as gentle as possible, so I'm going to put it like this. How many of you have at least one T on your paper, or you're sitting next to someone who has one T on their paper? All right. See, here's what I think happens to us in our world. We live in a world where we're constantly bombarded with messages that move us to a cycle. From the time that you were born, you have been given a message that says you should want more. You should always make more. You should acquire more. You should hoard more. And that those messages just kind of permeate our minds and our thoughts. And there it becomes, as a believer, it becomes somewhat of an obstacle that we have to constantly try to overcome. Sometimes we compare ourselves with those who have more than we do. And you know what that does? It stimulates the more cycle in us. And sometimes we worry about the future and we think, am I going to have enough? And you know what that does? When we worry about that, that stimulates the more cycle. And then there are tragedies that happen in our world, like just this last couple of weeks in Moore, Oklahoma, and in Oklahoma City, the tragedies. I just read this morning about a little 4-year-old child that is found floating in the river that had been missing. That's a tragedy. And we see pictures of suffering and pictures of hungry children, and then we come to church and we hear a message about the need for that and about money, and then we read something in the Bible and we kind of start feeling a little guilty about how much we actually really have and how much we are really blessed, and we feel a little bit guilty about that. And when we feel that guilt, maybe we take a stab at giving towards something like that or giving a little more, but eventually what happens is that when giving is motivated by guilt, it goes away eventually. And when the guilt goes away, we just get sucked back into the more cycle. And here's what I think. I think that guilt alone is not enough to break the more cycle in our lives. And it's not enough to develop the generous hearts that most of us, I believe, in this place today would want to have. That God would want for us. I think the only way to break through that kind of freedom is to trust God. To trust Him enough to go on an adventure with Him in regards to our stuff. And that's what brings me to this story this morning from Jesus, this parable that He teaches. And one of the key words that comes right at the beginning of this story, it had to be very striking for the listeners in Jesus' day to hear how Jesus was talking. And they would have heard something that you and I might not pick up on immediately. But what it says is that this man is going on a journey. He calls his servants and he gives his property to them. And what he gives them is astounding. See, in those days, there were no big corporations like we know them. Wealth actually was concentrated in just a few households. And this was one of them. And in this story, Jesus is talking about some staggering sums of money. I mean, you won't understand the story unless you appreciate that. One talent was worth 10,000 denarii. And a typical laborer, just to give you some perspective, a typical laborer would work for a day, and his wage at the end of that day would be one denarius. So a single talent represented 10,000 denarii. And in that day, people lived from one day to the next. They didn't have savings accounts. They didn't have 401ks. One denarius was a lot of money because it was sufficient for their day. And so 10,000 denarii represented a staggering fortune. So Jesus is talking about something that no one had ever expected to happen, that someone would be given five talents, or somebody would be given two talents. Not just one, but five and two. We're talking about staggering sums, where when the people heard this, they were going, wow, that's mind-blowing. Now, if I were one of the servants, and something like that happened to me, if someone did that for me, that would literally change my life. It would change your life. If I was one of those servants and something like that happened, it would change my life. And given a chance like that, any servant would say, this is a chance for me. It's a chance for me to exercise initiative. It's a chance for me to demonstrate my judgment. It's a test for me to show my skills in the marketplace and be able to rise to a position of greater authority. And not only that, there would have been in that culture underlying this an implicit promise to share in the profits of that deal as well. And see, you won't get this story unless you understand that it starts for each of these servants with a chance of a lifetime. It's unbelievable what Jesus is giving to the listeners there. Because this is becoming an act of staggering generosity on the part of the master. And it is a statement of confidence that he has in his servants. So each of the servants would have thought upon receiving this gift from their master, my master believes in me and he trusts me. This also explains, as you read this story, that little phrase in the story in verse 16 where Jesus says, and the man who received the five talents went out at once. Of course he did. Of course he went out at once, because this was the chance of a lifetime. He went out at once so the master wouldn't have a chance to change his mind. He didn't want to lose this opportunity, so he goes out at once. Now, it's very important to understand the answer to this question that I'm about to ask you. They received the talents from the master, and they went out at once. Here's the question. To whom did the money belong? It's not a rhetorical question. You can answer back. To whom did the money belong? It was the master's money. Was not the servant's money. It was money entrusted to the servant by the master. This is the master's money. The master is the owner, and the servant is the steward. And you know what? We'll never get this money deal right. We'll never really win this battle of the more cycle and fight it effectively if we do not settle the ownership issue. If you're here this morning and you've never settled the ownership issue, don't fight me. You'll have to fight God on this one. I think we all have a problem. And this is one thing that God wants to constantly remind me of in my own life. That there's a problem sometimes with the ownership issue. Several years ago, I was reading a great theological journal called the Reader's Digest. And I was sitting in a doctor's office and just picked this up. And there was this little story about a woman who had come to the airport. And she was sitting in the waiting area waiting to board the plane. And right before she had gotten there, she had bought a little bag of mini Oreo cookies. And she was going to eat them on the plane. And so she's sitting there in the waiting area. And this man comes and sits down beside her. And, you know, she's reading a little bit and thinking, and all of a sudden, she hears this crumple of someone putting a hand in the bag of cookies that was sitting right there. And this man reached in the bag of Oreo cookies and took out a cookie and looked at her and smiled and ate a cookie. This was very disturbing to the young woman. And she just didn't say much. It was obvious, perhaps, that this man didn't even speak English. And so she reached in and she grabbed a cookie and she ate it. And the man kind of smiled at her and nodded. And this went on. He would grab a cookie and eat it. She would grab a cookie and eat it. And he would grab one. And finally, they came to the last cookie. And he reaches in and gets the cookie and he breaks it in half and offers her half of the cookie, and she just kind of disdains it and turns away, and so he eats the whole thing. And she's just beside herself. They call them to get onto the plane, and she gets on the plane, and she sits down at her seat. She reaches into her bag to get her book that she's going to read, and she touches the bag of her Oreo cookies that had never been taken out of the bag or opened. She was eating his cookies. And she didn't even know it. But she thought she owned those. Listen, some of us in this room have a lot of cookies. Whose cookies are they really? We think sometimes that they're ours, and we wrestle. With this ownership deal. Ever been around a 2-year-old child? What's a 2-year-old child's favorite word other than no? Mine. My stuff, my blankie, my toy, my house. Of course, none of it is theirs. A 2-year-old did not earn any of that stuff. It's just an illusion. Only a 2-year-old can be that foolish, right? Right? My stuff. Can we maybe all confess that perhaps we have a little bit of 2-year-old in us? And really this whole message could be a short one if we could really get this ownership issue dealt with. See, if I go through life acting like an owner, then I say when things are required of my stuff, I say, it's my stuff. It's mine. And if I'm generous with my stuff, maybe I'll give you a few of my cookies. But they're mine. A steward says this. A steward says, none of it is mine. None of it is mine. It has been entrusted to me. But it belongs to somebody else. So, God, what should we do together with what you have given us? Say, that's the writer, the better heart. What we should learn here is that ownership for you and me as believers, maybe the world sees it way differently, but you and I, we have a greater perspective on that, right? For you and I, ownership is a myth. Stewardship is the reality. Ownership is a myth. It's a very enticing and very convincing myth in our society, but really and truly, stewardship is a reality. And this becomes very clear in this story. It becomes very clear in this story because as Jesus shares, one day, as the three or entrusted with what the master had given them, one day the master comes back, and he comes back to settle the accounts. He comes back to settle the accounts. He's going to come back, and he's going to say, what did you do with what I entrusted to you? There is a day for you and I as believers. There's a day coming for us where Jesus will say, one day, the Master's going to come back. And one day we're going to stand before the Lord and God will say to us, I know I gave you the chance of a lifetime. Everything that I've given you has been for the glory of the kingdom. I gave you a body. I gave you a mind. I gave you good work to do. I gave you blessings beyond. I gave you a house to live in. You maybe had a financial portfolio that was larger than most. What did you do with it? How did you bless the world with it? See, that settled accounts thing is kind of sobering, isn't it? That's the sobering part of this story, because the fact is that God is the Lord of the gift. He does give. He pours out and entrusts to us so much. He is the Lord of the gift, and He gives us opportunities in life, and that's good news. And the accountability thing, though, that's sobering news. See, there's this odd tendency in human beings to think that we never really are going to have to settle accounts about that. That we can maybe worm our way around or charm our way out of or finesse our way through the consequences of our actions. This can start early on in our lives. A family who will remain nameless, because every time I name them I get in trouble, had two children, and one of the two children, maybe 7 and 5 at the time, and one of the children was really having a very squirrely night at the dinner table. And as they were sitting down to dinner, the father said, "You're headed for trouble if you don't settle down." He was warned, and he didn't settle down. He was warned again and said that there will be serious consequences for not settling down, and the availability of Mr. Nintendo after supper or whatever. But he did not settle down, and then there was this spill of Exxon Valdez proportions or BP proportions, and so the father said to the child, "Okay, you know the consequences of what happened, and I'm gonna have to hold you accountable for that." And the father, not kidding, the father saw the child reach into his pocket, pull out a dollar bill, and wave it at him, and says, "Maybe Mr. Washington can change your mind." 7 years old. See, we think we can skirt the consequences. But Jesus says that there's one before whom we will all stand. And He really will ask to settle accounts for everything that He gives. Everything that you and I have received. And we will not be able to finesse our way out of that kind of conversation. Mr. Washington will not change his mind. The Master comes back. And Jesus makes it very clear. He comes back. And two of the servants have invested what their master gave them with courage and with skill. And the third one buried it. And the third one, in the conversation with the master, tries to finesse his way out of the trouble. The thing is that's interested into me is that the one talent guy is the one who does this. It's the one talent guy who does this. And let me put a little pause here for a second. Because Jesus does something unusual in this parable. Usually when He's telling a parable about honoring and pleasing God, that there would be two characters in the parable. One who does the right thing and one who does the wrong thing. For example, the parable about the wise man who built his house on the rock and the foolish man who built his house on the right. Or the Pharisee who prayed with arrogance and pride, or the tax collector who was very humble. In this story, in this parable, it's different because Jesus has three characters. Three. One of them gets 5 talents. One of them gets 2 talents. And both of those received the exact same commendation from the master. The one who gave five and doubled it, and the one who had two and doubled it, they both get the exact same commendation from the master. Why does Jesus have a third person there? I think one of the reasons is that Jesus wants to teach us it's not about how many talents you're given. See, it says that he gave to each according to their ability. It's not about how many talents you're given. It's not about how visible your accomplishments are for God, even though they may appear to be great to everyone else. It's not about how big your portfolio is. It's not about any of that stuff, because comparison is so destructive. You know what it's about? It's about what you do with what you have. And so maybe what's going on in this story is that the one talent guy, when he sees the disbursements, he's going, well, my talent doesn't count very much in this whole transaction. I mean, he got five, he got two, I just got one. And maybe he's thinking, my talent doesn't count very much. Or maybe he's mad that he doesn't have as much as the others. But the only question that God is going to ask you and he's going to ask me when he settles accounts is this. He's going to ask, what did you do with what I gave you around this issue? What did you do with what I gave you? He's not going to ask, what did you do with what I gave somebody else? Because see, this will be about you and it'll be about me. When he comes to the one talent guy and asks him what he did, the answer was interesting. I knew you were a hard man, master. And I was afraid. I was afraid. You see, that's another key word. I think the reason that Jesus used this word is because I think most of us in this place would say, I would love to be more generous. I would love to have the more cycle kind of becoming less and less evident in my life. I don't want my giving to be based on guilt. I would want to be more generous with what God has given me. I think most of us would say I would want to have a giving heart. And the reason being is because I think most of us really and truly understand what Jesus did for us. We understand the gospel. We understand grace. But what holds us back is fear, perhaps. I'm afraid that when I get old, there's not going to be enough left. I'm afraid that I won't be secure. I'm afraid that I'm going to miss out on some kind of thrill that others are having that I'm not able to have. I'm afraid that I won't look really important. I'm afraid that if I'm keeping score and money is the way that I keep score, that I'm not going to win in the end. I'm afraid. And that's why Jesus teaches us so much about money in Scripture. Because really, it's a trust issue. It's a barometer that measures what do I really trust in. And so the one talent guy tries to finesse his way out of this. And he says, you know, master, I knew you were a hard guy, so I buried your money. He's blaming the master for his performance. I knew you were a hard guy, so I buried it. And the master, of course, hears this. And he responds, and he uses two very extraordinary words to describe this third servant. And this, too, is a very sobering part of the story, because he basically says, you are a wicked and lazy servant. You're wicked and lazy. Or he used the word slothful. You're a wicked and slothful servant. That's striking, isn't it? That the master would use those terms. We don't usually use those terms together very much, wicked and lazy, wicked and slothful. Historically, Christians took laziness so seriously that it was listed as one of the seven deadly sins, by the way. But nobody today admits to laziness at all. I was reading a little journal the other day, and there was this description of what a real job interview looks like today, and one the writer of the article basically said that in job interviews today, whenever someone is asked, what is your biggest fault? People usually say something like this. My biggest fault? Well, I'd say I work too hard. I mean, my standards are way high, and I'm too much of a perfectionist. So what's your biggest fault? Well, I just push myself too much. I push myself too hard. And this guy says, nobody in the job interview ever says, you know what my biggest problem is? My biggest problem is I'm just too darn lazy. I can sit on a sofa and watch TV for hours. It's unbelievable my capacity for doing nothing. Nobody says that. But this word here, slothfulness, laziness, it does not necessarily mean just inactivity. Because see, you can look really busy and still be lazy in the sense. Because lazy here is, as Jesus refers to it, slothful here as Jesus refers to it, is it's the refusal. Listen to this. It's the refusal to do what needs to be done when it needs to be done. It's a refusal to do what needs to be done when it needs to be done. It's a refusal to carry out the one thing that has been assigned to you. It's kind of like the kamikaze pilot who flew 17 missions, all right? You know, that's the first time I've ever told that joke and somebody actually got it. Thank you so much. I feel so better. I'm so much better. What it's a failure to leverage what I have been given to do God's work in the world. And it's striking that Jesus is so serious about this kind of inactivity. Throughout the centuries, people have had a problem with this parable. In the second century, there was a manuscript called the Gospel of the Nazarene. And in this manuscript, there's this same account of Jesus telling this parable. But the writer kind of fools with the parable a little bit, and he adds a sentence that Jesus never used, because the writer says that the one talent servant blew all of his money on harlots and flute players. That's what he wrote in there. See, he thought, this is what he thought, that the guy must have had done something really bad with the money. So the worst thing he could think of were harlots and flute players, so he kind of wrote that in. But Jesus did not say that. What Jesus says is that you did not do anything with it. You did not put it to work for the master. You just buried it. You just used it up. You just took it and you buried it. He had a once-in-a-life lifetime opportunity, but he was afraid. And the one thing that the master entrusted to him was simply buried. And I tell you, there are real serious consequences for this guy as you read the end of this parable. The desire for money can pull your heart away from God like nothing else on earth can. It can, but that's not really God's desire, because you see, God is, he wants you to get the money thing right, because he's the Lord of reward as much as he is the Lord of accounts. He's the Lord of the gift. He's the one who gives this amazing gift, but he's also the Lord of the accounts, that he will bring in account one day what he has given to us. But he is the Lord of reward. And he called the five-talent servant and the two-talent servant in, and he heard what they did, and he blessed them even more. Well done, good and faithful servant. Can you imagine hearing that from the Father? Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. A few things? This is like a lot of money. Staggering amounts of money. 10,000, 20,000, and 50,000 denarii. Multiple lifetime fortunes. But he said to them, you've been faithful with a little bit. Now I'm going to put you in charge of many things. Your adventure is just starting. See, if you trust God with your resources, that's what we have to understand that we need to relearn, because we probably need to relearn this more than we've had to learn any of the other things that I've talked about, because it is the one thing that absolutely isn't so intensely personal. But if you trust God with your resources, if you make your life a kind of kingdom assignment, The reward is that you get to do God's work. And you get to see God work. And you get to partner with Him. And you get to partner with Him more and more and more as you do this. And you experience a spiritual adventure that will delight God and start to change the world, bless people, and bring true, true joy to you. It will make you a radiantly joyful person, because nobody who gives deeply fails to become a more joyful person in regards to what they're doing. And when you give, it's not just about you anymore. It's not just about me anymore. I turn my life and my stuff and my money over to God, and then it's just Jesus and me together. And then watch what happens when we do that. The Master's looking for people that He can entrust His stuff to. He's looking for people that if He brings it to you, that you will be true with it. That you will see it the right way. I have two illustrations and we'll close this morning. But I have a friend who was telling me about a man that he heard years ago speak in a church. His name was John Bechtel. And John Bechtel lived in Hong Kong. He was a businessman there. And he and a few other people wanted to start a Christian camp for kids in Hong Kong. He was a believer. He goes to a church in Hong Kong that my friend, who was a missionary there, he went to his church. And Hong Kong, of course, is this city where sometimes as many as 5,000 people live in a single high-rise on an acre of ground. And so they desired to have this camp where kids could actually get out into nature and meet God and not have to just see concrete all the time. And so they found out that there was this company in Hong Kong that had built a facility on some acreage. And they had built this facility for $1 million. And the company said that they would sell this facility to John Bechtel and his group because of what they wanted to do. They would sell it to him for $250,000. That's a bargain in itself. And so one of John's colleagues says, well, you know, let's try to raise some money. And so they started trying to raise money. And for 3 months, John worked at trying to raise the money. And he literally got hardly any response. Nobody wanted to give towards this need. But he received one letter from a little girl in Georgia named Melinda Holmes. And this is the letter that she wrote to him. Dear John Bechtel, please find my ice cream money for 2 weeks enclosed. Please use it to help buy a camp for young people in Hong Kong. And there was $1 inside the envelope. And after 2 months, that's all he got. $1. And so he gathered his friends together and says, this is what I came up with. I got a dollar. And they said, well, it's worth a try. And so they went into the company boardroom and he said to them, I didn't quite come up with the $250,000. And they said, well, how much did you come up with? And he says, I got a dollar. And so they went back into their boardroom and they came out and the answer was, well, if the camp's going to be used to help young kids, we're going to sell it to you for a dollar. And they did. They sold it to him for a dollar. And that dollar is now framed in the camp as a reminder of what God can do when someone is faithful. And as of today, over 1 million children have attended this camp in Hong Kong, and there have been 100,000 conversions as a result of that. But there's more to the story. John came back to the United States and was going around speaking in churches, and when he would go and speak in these churches, he would tell this story. And there was a young man, young woman, who came up to him after he had been in one particular church, and she came up to him and she says, my name is Melinda Holmes. I was that little girl. And they talked for a moment, and finally he just thanked her, and he said, would you like to go over to Hong Kong and see what happened there? And she says, yes, I would. And so people were beginning to go out of the church, and so John called them back in. He says, hey, come back in here. We're going to take up another offering. You know, that would scare most of us to death, wouldn't it? Well, we're going to take up a second offering. And so they raised enough money to fly Melinda Holmes over to Hong Kong, and she walked through the camp. She saw what God had done, and tears flowed from her eyes. This little girl, $1. What does Jesus say to her? Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. And the master is still looking for people that he can trust that stuff to, who will take on kingdom assignments like that and allow things to happen as an adventure for God. One of my favorite testimonies of this is about a young man by the name of Toby Long. Toby was in high school when this occurred several years ago. He went with World Vision to Africa on a development project, and they were at this food distribution center, and there were a lot of kids hanging around. Of course, you know, when food is there, there's a lot of children. And so one boy, about 11 years old, kind of shadowed Toby all day long. And when it was time to go, he started to tug at Toby's shirt as he was getting on the bus to go back to their camp. And Toby realized that this kid wants my shirt. He wants my shirt. And of course, Toby didn't have an extra shirt with him at the distribution center. So he realized that if he was going to give the shirt off his back, he would have to go around without a shirt for the rest of the day. And you know, that was going to be a problem because he was really fair-skinned, and his mom had warned him about getting exposed to the sun, and it would feel kind of strange to go around without a shirt. And he didn't have much time and had to decide in the moment. So he just kind of sort of pushed the boy away gently and got on the bus, and he kept his shirt. And he watched all these kids run after the bus and the way they do and wave goodbye. And Toby knew that he would never see that little boy again. But he had a troubled spirit. When the team went back to their compound where they stayed that night, Toby couldn't sleep, and he got up to be alone with God. And that story that kept coming to him from Matthew 25, whatever you did for the least of these, you would do it to me. And it just gnawed at him. And so he came back home from Africa, and it kept him up at night. And he woke up at 1 o'clock one night, and he thought, you know what, I've got to do something about this. And finally, God gave him an idea. He says, I was in Ethiopia where a kid would be thrilled to get one t-shirt. I live in America. Now, let me put this in a form of a question to you. Does anybody in here have any extra t-shirts? I have so many t-shirts that they kind of mate with each other and spawn little t-shirts. All right? So Toby thought to himself, maybe I should collect some t-shirts and send them over to Ethiopia. And so he started going from door to door, knocking and asking people if they had any t-shirts. He called it the Give the Shirt Off Your Back campaign. And word began to spread, and everyone had extra t-shirts. And then it got spread to the news outlets, and television stations started to carry the story. 7-Eleven put bins in their stores to collect donated t-shirts. And at the end of this, Toby ended up with about 18,000 t-shirts. And then he had to sort through them and get rid of the ones with the holes and stains in them because, you know, sometimes we don't give our best there. The holes and stained t-shirts, you know, that's the kind that your wife gets rid of when you're not looking, because even though you loved it ever since you were in college, it's now going to have to be gone. But I digress. But here, but Toby, when he got finished, still had 10,000 like new t-shirts. And now he had another problem. How was he going to get them to Africa, and particularly Ethiopia? And he hadn't thought about this, so he spends 3 months calling every relief organization that he could find, and all of them are turning him down and saying, no way. And there was this guy who's been storing them in the warehouse, and now he needs the place, and so the shirts have to be out in a week. And Toby's just praying, what are we going to do with all these t-shirts? And, you know, he just went to God. He says, okay, God, you have all these t-shirts. How are you going to get them to Africa? And so one day he gets a call from CNN, and they say, is this Toby Long? Yes, sir. Are you the t-shirt kid? Yes, sir. Well, Toby, we have found a relief agency that can get the shirts over to Africa. We don't know where in Africa they're going to go, but they can do it, and we'll do it for free. Are you interested in that? And Toby says, of course, yes. And so they took the shirts, and they called Toby back afterwards. And they said, Toby, we dropped them off in a country that normally would never let anything like that come through customs. But we ended up taking them on an Air Force jet that doesn't have to go through customs, and they made it, all of them, all 10,000. And we wanted to let you know what country they went to. What country do you think they went to? Ethiopia, right? Ethiopia. $1, an idea about t-shirts. One story about a high school boy and a and a little girl giving up her ice cream money, what do you think God is going to say to them in the end when the account comes? Well done, good and faithful servant. Toby graduated from college. He ended up going to Princeton, where he earned a master's degree, Master of Divinity degree. He's in medical school. He's going to become a doctor. He spends his life serving. He wants to spend his life serving under-resourced people and under-resourced parts of the world. See, Jesus is the Lord of the gift. He can take a couple of fish and a couple of loaves and he can feed 5,000 people. He can take a widow's mite and turn it into a story that inspires people to give for thousands of years. He can take 12 bumbling, stumbling guys and turn the world upside down. And he can take us on an adventure. But we've got to settle the ownership issue. We've got to settle it. We've got to learn or relearn what that's all about.